So I'm glad I get to share with you tonight. These are the kinds of teachings that come around this practice are very exciting for me to talk about, and I definitely have a passion for it. I once was on a retreat, it happened to be a Buddhist retreat, but they were talking about how they brought over some teacher from the East, and he had a very, they took him all around. He had a very busy schedule. And then there was finally one day when there wasn't anything on the schedule, and they said to him, what would you like to do today? And he said, well, is there anywhere I can go teach Dharma? You know, so... and I've started teaching longer retreats, too. So I teach a three-week retreat where I get to do this every night. So there's a lot of things that I like to talk about, but and it's a tremendous pleasure to share and to hear other people's words. It's much better for you if you get to hear multiple voices. So the title of the talk tonight is "Where Can I Not Find You?" Where can I not find you? I led a retreat with my two friends, Rabbi Sheila Weinberg and Sylvia Boorstein. Sylvia's the person who introduced me to these teachings. So the three of us led a retreat together, and there was a theme for the retreat. We offered this retreat, and the title of the retreat was Lecha Dumia Tehillah. It was a verse from Psalm 65, verse 2. Lecha Dumia Tehillah. To you, silence is praise. So we had a meeting to plan the retreat ahead of time, which is also something I don't tend to do a lot of, but some people that I work with think that's really a good idea. And like I had no idea what James was going to talk about until I got here, or what Stephen was going to talk about. But we had a planning meeting, partly because the three of us had led about 40 retreats together. We actually wouldn't have had a planning meeting, but there were some other people connected to the project, and they wanted us to have a planning meeting, so we had a planning meeting. But at the meeting, Sheila said, "I have this idea. I think." Since the retreat was going to have was 4 days long, but three nights, so there were going to be three talks like that. We each got to give one talk, and Sheila said, "I have an idea. Let's take the three words lecha, dumia, tehillah, and each one of us will do a talk on one of those subjects." And she had an idea in mind too. She said to Sylvia, "Why don't you talk about praise, and I'll talk about silence." And Jeff, you probably want to talk about God, which was, she sort of had me pegged on that level. That was not incorrect, but she didn't quite have it right. Even as she made that suggestion, I was thinking, "Oh, I'll do lecha," you know. I was definitely thinking that, but not to do a talk about God, because what that implies is I want to give a talk about talking to God. Not talking about God. And I started using that language earlier in the week. That's a big problem, and Stephen then picked up on it too. Talking about God is not the point. And in fact, is a way to get farther away. So I think, as I probably said Sunday night, in my teaching, I want to make reference to the yud and the hey and the vav and the hey. I want to use language that's where the divine is mentioned, because I do think that part of that central to Jewish mindfulness meditation is where does God fit into that? That, at least for me, that's a central piece. I love mindfulness. I love the practice of mindfulness. I think this is I think what we're doing here, there are different practices for different people, but I think mindfulness, practicing mindfulness, I think is sort of the peak spiritual practice on the planet. I think there are other important things to do. It's almost like it's a fundamental thing. I think it's hard to be awake and see clearly. And I think it's such a powerful practice. But I don't want to talk about God. I want to be speaking about what it's like to talk to God. It was not about talking about God. So that's the main point. There are a few points I want to make. So this is about talking to God, not about God. I'll make a really strong point that the way to talk to God is to listen. That's how you talk to God, is to listen. I hope to address that there's something between a non-dual approach to the divine and a dualistic approach to the divine, and that is a relational approach. So I hope to be talking about a relational approach to the divine, as opposed to a non-dual or a dual. Another important point I hope to make is that we can experience the divine as you. Oh, it's you. Oh, you. We can experience the divine as you. And we can experience everything as you. We can experience absolutely everything as, oh, you. And if we do that, then we fall in love with you. That's how we can fall in love with you. It's how if we can fall in love with everything. So what does it mean to say you? What is this word you? What does it mean to say the word you? Or in a stronger, maybe more important than what does it mean to say you, because words can come out of your mouth and they may or may not mean anything. So even more important than saying you, what does it mean to experience you? What does it mean to experience the universe as you, and experience the divine as you? What does it mean to say you to God? So lecha. What does it mean to say you to God? To address God as you. To address the divine as you. And it's not really God. God is just a three-letter word in the dictionary. Elohim is just a word it's just a concept in the dictionary. Yud hey and vav and hey is still just a concept of a word. But what does it mean to say you to the divine of the universe? And there is an automatic problem that I think people immediately understand in saying you to anybody or anything, and that is saying you has a sense of dualism to it. It's a dualistic approach, because when we say you, there's a sense of a me and a sense of a you. So it's a dualistic approach, and I had a close friend who used to encourage me to do meditation before I knew anything about meditation. He was very involved in the Jewish renewal world that I was a part of. His name is David Tapper. He passed away a couple of years ago, about 2 or 3 years ago now. And he loved all the work we were doing. He loved Jewish renewal. He loved meditation. He encouraged us all to say we need to make meditation more central to the work we're doing before any of us were doing it. All the people who are leading it now, he was saying, you guys should all, bring this in, even before we were doing it personally. And maybe except Sylvia was already doing it by then. I think Sheila also had not yet started. But the prayers drove him nuts. And he loved coming, he loved participating, but the prayers themselves drove him nuts. And every time, the major point was, every time we said you, because he was into non-dualism, he was very into non-dualism. And who are you talking to? Why are you still using that language? What's this you? Because others of us also said non-dualism. We were talking about non-dualism. So who are you? But the prayers, and he had a lot of trouble with that. And the truth is, even on this retreat, I've had a number of one-on-one sessions with people where people have reported, I really like the prayers, but I can't really relate to the words. And we've really, obviously, they're very selected. They're already quite highly selected, which words we're going to chant in the morning compared to the whole liturgy. So I've already weeded out the things that I don't like to say. And even then, the things I can't relate to. Now, it's not that I don't. It's not somebody I don't like to say them. It's like I can't have. I don't have a relationship. It's not how I think. And so a number of people here have said, you know, I like the singing is great. I feel good during it, but I can't relate to the words we're using. And they've said things like, you know, I have no problem walking around and looking at a flower and feel God's there, but it's not in those words. So the words is a problem. A dualistic sense is a problem. And David Tapper would always push us about that. So I'm going to come back to a little bit about the problem of dualism. So here is this is the Hasidic approach to this question. This is a Hasidic approach to this question of view. This is a teaching of Reb Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. So I'd like to share with you a song that he wrote. I don't know about the melody. I know he wrote the words. Although I'm going to do some of his words and then it's adapted, so which you won't find surprising. I mean, you won't be surprised to hear that it's adapted, but it starts with his words, not lots of his words, and the whole sentiment is his, I think. Riboino shalaylam, Riboino shalaylam, Riboino shalaylam. Riboino shel olam, Riboino shel olam. Ich will dir a dudele singen, du, 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 du. Holy being of the world, holy being of the world, holy being of the world. Holy being of the world, holy being of the world, I want to sing a doodle for you. Do, 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 do. Where shall I seek you? And where shall I not seek you? Where can I find you? And where can I not find you? Do, 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 do. You, 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 you. If I go, you. If I stay, you. Only you, always you. Here, you, there, you. You, 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 you. Do, 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 do. Oz is good, do. Cholila schlecht euch, do. When it's good, you. For fan sorrow, you. Do, 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 do. You, 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 you. Tingle you, pressure you, warm you, cold you, 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 you. Judgment you, patience you, pleasant you, unpleasant you, 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 you. Walking you, sitting you, standing you, eating you, 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 you. Praise you, blame you, fame you, ill repute you, 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 you. Do, 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 do. So I added some at the end, but the whole beginning is his. The English translation, "Holy Being of the World," is my translation instead of saying "Ribono Shel Olam." I like that a little better than "Master of the World." But what I add is totally within the sentiment. I added some verses, but I don't think that Levi Yitzchak would have any trouble with what we just said. I think he would. Oh yeah. Sensations in the body, definitely. It's all you. That I think. So I just added to what he was teaching. And this was his approach to the divine. And it wasn't a brand new. This is, in fact, this is an old sentiment. The Psalms certainly pick up on the sentiment. Wherever you go, there's God. There's you. Whatever you experience, there's you. And we say that in the Psalms. So, Gam ki elech begeit salmavet, lo ira ra ki ata imadi. You know, even if I'm walking through the valley of the shadow of death, there you are. You know, or im esach shamayim, sham ata. Va'atzia she'ol hineka. If I ascend to the heaven, you. Even if I go into the depths of Sheol, also you. So this is not a brand new idea, and this is an old idea in Judaism. Now it seems to me when I say those words from the Psalms, usually I think it would be possible to have a different experience, but mostly when we say those words in the Psalms, we're sort of reminding ourselves that somebody had that experience. And sometimes if we're in a really difficult situation and we say those words, it reminds us to look at the situation and maybe we can have that experience that, it's you, it's still you there. And it's the fact that the Psalms address the divine as you, that language even, of addressing the divine as you, is the reason why, from the structural point of view that I've been trying to do the morning prayers with you, that's the reason why the Psalms are in Psukei Dezimra, is because they address the divine as you. They fit perfectly in this four worlds framework I'm talking about. Because that world of prayer is called Yetzira or Ruach. So I'll mention that again when we look at the sheet briefly. So I want to now introduce, I want to move into talking about Martin Buber a little bit, the teachings of Martin, a particular teaching of Martin Buber was the central teaching he had in his book, I and Thou. Buber was a Hasidic scholar. He certainly knew this Dudele. He certainly knew this Hasidic approach to the divine, that saying you to everything. And I would guess that's a part of the origin of how he wrote this book, how he came to the theology he had, because I and Thou is his theology book. That's his explanation of experiencing the divine directly in I and Thou. And I'm going to get to that. I'm going to talk a lot about that book. So what Reb Levi Yitzchak was doing with the Hasidic, Reb Levi Yitzchak was doing was deeply personalizing something. Like we learned earlier in the week, both Joanna mentioned and James mentioned the whole concept of Tzimtzum. So then you have this, which is it's a description of the divine origin of the universe, but it's very much a conceptualization. Maybe it came out of an experience, but so in here you have a the Kabbalistic approach about talking to the divine is that God withdrew God's self. And then a vacuum was created, and in the vacuum light arose, and that's a lot different than saying, "Oh, I love you so much." You know, they're both talking about God, but one is very heady, and the other one is, "Oh, I just love you. You're everything. You're everywhere." That's a lot different than saying the Tzimtzum, and if you read other Kabbalistic things, even more convoluted compared to, "Oh, I just love you. You're everything." What at least some of the Hasidic masters were doing were singing a love song to God, singing a love song to the divine. And that's what I really want to emphasize in this talk. I want to emphasize the singing of a love song. And I think that's what we're doing with mindfulness practice. I think what mindfulness practice, if we keep working with it, eventually helps us to sing a love song to ourselves and to the universe. I think that is the fruit that comes out of mindfulness practice. And really, as a love song, not talking about. So even our beautiful sentiments like V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, that's still a thought. That's talking about love. That's different than saying I love you. And I think this practice takes us to the place of saying I love you, not explaining how love would be a really good thing to manifest. So it is a really good thing to manifest. But the practice takes to the place of, oh, I love you. I love you. I love this. I love this you. When we do this practice, we stop, the practice of mindfulness, we stop being in opposition to our own experience, to pushing away our own experience, and instead we embrace our own experience. And I'm deliberately using that word. We embrace our own experience. You know, we hold it lovingly in an embrace. So here's what I think Martin, this is the teaching I got from Ayin Thou and from Martin Buber is incredibly central to how I'm able to say you to God. So to do it, just have that, if you have that little sheet handy, you have the yud in the hay and the vav in the hay. It's supposed to be a roadmap. I'm not thinking about the yud in the hay and the vav in the hay as a concept or a name. I'm thinking about them as a roadmap that points how to understand everything, how to experience everything, how to see everything as a part of the you of the divine. And I first learned about this teaching from Reb Zalman Schachter Shlomi. I went on a retreat with him. It was where I met him. I started hearing about him and heard a couple of audio tapes, cassette tapes, and they still use that technology. But then he came out to Portland, Oregon, where I was living, and I got a chance to spend a weekend with him, with a chabura that I was a part of. We brought him there. And on Shabbat afternoon, he said, "What are your biggest questions? You know, ask me anything you want to ask about the universe, about God." And you know, and 10 people asked questions. He didn't say anything. He took this person asked a question. This person asked a question. Now he took 10 questions, and then he started to talk, and he answered all 10 questions with one answer. It was really clear. It was crystal clear. He just gave a little coherent talk that answered all 10 questions. It was just one answer. And this is the answer. He talked about the four worlds and how everything you could ask is included, how this addresses everything, because it's a practice that unfolds everything. And he figured out how to boil that down into 12 words, too. He could, on top of it all, so we're going to do a 12-word chant in English. I'll do it once in Spanish, because I happen to know it in Spanish, because we teach in Mexico now. And some of you know that, maybe a lot of you know this chant, but these 12 words explain all the whole reality map of the four different worlds, just in these 12 words. It goes like this. It is perfect. You are loved. All is clear, and I am holy. It is perfect. You are love. All is clear, and I am holy. Eo es perfecto, tu eres herida. Todo está claro, y yo soy sagrado. It is perfect. You are love. All is clear, and I am holy. So that first verse, it is perfect, is Zalman, that's his way of explaining what this world we call Asiya, in those four worlds. We have also the words Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, and Chaya. Each of those worlds has a name. It's the world of Asiya. So that whole reality, that's the reality of how the divine, which is just the beingness of the universe, from the way I want to talk about it, the yud in the hay and the vav in the hay is just the verb to be. That's the insight that came to Moses. It was very directly. I will be what I will be. Ehyeh asher ehyeh. It's just being. If you want to know what's sending you somewhere, it's just being. It's just how the unfolding of being. but in this four worlds model that comes out of the Jewish mystical tradition. So one of the ways that the divine manifests, that divine being manifests, is as physicality. It's this world of things and objects. And this world is characterized by that phrase, it is perfect. And I think Zalman intentionally, in the language for the, it is perfect in the next world, you are loved, was also drawing off of Buber's teaching in I and Thou. The world of Asiya is the world of disparate objects. It's all God. It's also God. God manifests as, and this is part of the question of duality, non-duality. So relatively, from a Jewish mystical perspective, there is a way that the divine manifests as multiplicity, as dualistic things, as separate objects, at least the appearance of separate objects in the physical world. And the way of relating, the way that we can relate to them is with the language, the objectified language, it. All these objects are just, they're the objects of the world of it. And this object's an it, and there's it, and it, and it, and it, and it, and it. And Buber would say, what Buber said about that is, the basic way that we go through our lives, most of the time, the way the mind is organizing data is through speech and the primary word. He created a term called the primary word, and he said the primary word, which I didn't really understand. I've been talking about this for a year. I didn't really understand till this year, I don't think. But what Buber is saying is that the primary word, meaning the main word that the human being's mind uses to process experience, the most important single word is the word I, it. It's not a word we actually say out loud, but it is a but what Buber is saying is that's how the mind organizes data to relate to the universe, and to and all the relating that we have internally in our minds has a subjective sense of an I that's doing the relating, and relating to everything in the universe as it. Everything is just an object to that I. And if you can, you have to try to think of that as a single concept or a single word. So he called it the primary word. Oh, I, it. I, it's what's happening. And it's all perfect. In the objectified world, things work just the way they need to work. So that's why that word is, it's not actually a good word or a bad word. Just things are the way they are. It is the way it is, and it unfolds perfectly. There's a perfect set of rules of the universe, how in that objectified universe, how the objects relate to each other, and unfolds perfectly. It is perfect, and it's all it. And Buber would say that's the primary way that the human mind is relating to life moment by moment. And he also called it the world of alienation and isolation and separation. So it's a very lonely position, I, it. It's a very, very, it's a very strong, powerful feeling of separation. It's all God still. Asiya is not out of the realm of God. It's an aspect of the divine. It's the dualistic, apparent dualistic aspect of the divine. And then Buber goes on in the book and says, because most of the time that's the case. We're in this place of I, it. But every so often, he said we can't really control it, but every so often, instead of relating to the world as an it, it's like, oh, it's you. Oh, there you are, you know. Oh, it's you, you know. Oh, and you. So I'm here doing my I, it thing, you know. I'm the teacher. I'm supposed to give a talk. This is the talk. You're the subjects, you know. But then you smile. You got what I'm saying. See, as soon as I see that somebody, somehow has to, a connection has to get made. And then I'm not just giving my, oh, it's you. Oh, there you are. Oh, and you too, you know. And some connection has to be made for the object to stop being an it. It's not sufficient just to say, oh, I'm looking at you. But you somehow have to actually, you have to watch somebody's eyes and see somehow you have to see into what's going on inside of them rather than what's going on inside of me. What's going on inside of me is I want to give a good talk. You know, I want you to like it. I wrote this up, so I want to say this good. So I want to give a good talk tonight. I want to be clear. These are all the I it statements, actually. Inside the mind, this is really all I it. Underneath the other language. So I want to give a good talk. I want it to be clear. I want to be funny. I want you to like it. I want you to like me. So this is all I-it thinking in the mind that's happening. So the I is central to the experience of all of those, underneath all those words, the I is central to the experience. So I want to give a good talk. A good talk is an idea. It's not the talk. The talk is unfolding now, but I want to give a good talk. That's a mental object. The idea of a good talk is a mental object, and I want it. That's an object I want. That's it's an I-it, and it's an objectified relationship. This is what I want. I want this I-it experience of a good talk. I want it to be clear. Still a mental object. I want it to be a certain kind of talk. I want to own that. I want to have that too. And I want it to be funny. I want to own that too. These are all things that I want to do. To the extent that while I was putting these thoughts together, I could try to know what my experience of life is like and try to intuit what other people's experience of life is like. So there could be some of a more relational thing happening as it was composed. But then there's also this level of just of objectifying the whole experience. And I want you to like me. So I want you to have the mental object in your mind. I like Jeff. Not only do I want you to have that mental object happening in your mind, I want you to give it to me. It's not good enough, you know, in terms of what I want. It's not, you know, if I don't know you like me, that's not good enough. I want that object, you know. In some ways, I want that object. And I don't care who you are. On that level, I want that object. That is all I is thinking. So Buber would say, but sometimes you stop, and sometimes you start seeing what's going on inside of the object. You know, and in order to do that, you have to make a connection. And that once the connection is made, then it's I and you, and the and is manifesting. The and is the connection, and the and is the vav of yud hey vav hey. And it's not an accident. I think Buber was deliberately teaching out of this same metaphor. Oh, Vav, the world of Ruach, this is the world of connecting. That's the world where, so in Asiya, with Nefesh, so then there's disparate, separate objects. But the world of Yetzira, which is the next world, which is has the word Ruach, you'll see on the sheet, so Yetzira is the name of the world, Ruach is the soul level word for it. Ruach is the quality of connecting, and it's vav. It's connecting because vav is connecting. Vav, and what does a vav do? It also is a hook, right? In Hebrew, a vav is a hook. So what does an do? What does a vav do? It takes this object, and it takes this object, and once they're hooked, now if this one moves, this one moves. You can't. There's no way. Once the and is manifesting, now there's what I really like about that is it's relational. That it doesn't completely remove the I and the object, but neither are they completely separate anymore. So it leaves, and this is where I was saying, you know, there's a dualistic understanding of how the divine manifests, which I think is true of Asiya. There's a completely non-dualistic way in which the divine manifests, which is in the realm of the fourth world on their chart. That's the world of I think the closest way to talk about it would be awareness. And one of the reasons I wanted to do that practice with you this afternoon, most of you had a chance to do it at 5:15, is that that's a way of practicing where the emphasis, this big mind meditation we did, I would actually like to know at some point by talking to you, you know, how did that work for you? You know, what happened when you did that? So one of the, I think besides having to share the talks at night, which I really find with, in some ways the hardest thing about having so many teachers is I didn't get to talk to so many of you, you know. Even by Saturday, I'm only going to get to talk to three quarters of you. That's where this retreat, it is sort of an objectified experience until that happens. You know, I trust the material. I know what we're teaching. I know it'll work for you. And then when I talk to you, you stop being like an object out there. And it completely changes what I say. The next time I come to sit down, if I've had those individual one-on-one sessions, I start teaching it a little differently. Because then I'm not just doing my thing. I'm doing what I know that relates to what you told me. And so I change what I'm going to say. I change what I'm going to teach. I change the order of how we're going to present things, all sorts of things. Because it's you. I want to talk to you. I don't want to just talk. You know, I mean, the it part of me might want to, but so Buber, this was Buber's theology. Buber said this is the direct experience of the divine, when the sense of the and manifesting, feeling that sense of the and manifesting, and it was called the theology of Das Wissen. Translating the book into English, the key for Buber in this, even in the languaging of the word "you," is he built it off the fact that in German you have two different words for you. When you have somebody that you have a formal, that we are not really connected to them, the German word for you in that case is Sie, right? And the title of the book is Ich und Du. When you know somebody, you can call them Du. This is the Dudele. It's the same thing that that Lev Yitzchak is doing. When you're familiar with somebody, you have to know them. You have to have, you know, be close to them. Then you can say you. You can say Du. And Buber was saying, we want to get to this place where instead of saying Z to the universe, we're saying you to the universe. In order for that to happen, the and has to manifest. The connection has to manifest. The experience of the ruach level of the divine, that the connecting force itself of and is pulling the disparate objects together. So I was saying, so what we did in this afternoon was moving in the direction, it's sort of on the edge of mindfulness practice, because the practice we actually did is more of a Tibetan practice. Sometimes called big mind, big sky, and you hopefully you may have touched into seeing in that practice that there's a way where, and it's true. I think this is capturing another truth, the truth of practicing more in the world of Atzilut, which is, in the place of big mind, all the things that are arising are like clouds arising in the sky and passing. So you have thoughts; they just arise. So the mind is bigger than the thoughts. This place of awareness. In this afternoon's practice, there was an equation basically between mind and from a Jewish perspective, it was a practice of mochin de gadlut, as opposed to mochin de katnut. In mochin de katnut, we're caught up in the our mind is working in this subject object duality, but there is a way to cultivate just. Being the knowing. Sometimes that's the instruction that's sometimes given. Be the knowing. And even the dualistic approach in mindfulness sometimes takes us into that place. The basic approach we're using for mindfulness starts out is from a very dualistic perspective. When you come here, we tell you to sit down. You take advantage of having this sense of an I. And we say, you from that position of your I, pick an object. It's very objective. I pick an object, direct the attention to the object. So the whole practice initially starts out with subject and object. It's not in its design original. It doesn't start out as a non-dual practice. Some people have a critique of it. So in the of this practice that we're teaching in the Tibetan world, in the Dzogchen, where Dzogchen is the practice of this big mind, non-dualistic. All unitive. At least one teacher, I've been told, says, "Oh, this when you pick an object and you direct the attention to it, he calls that stupid meditation because it starts out dualistic." But in my experience, I think he's correct. It does start out in that place because the positions that happen when we start to do mindfulness from that perspective, there is a sense of an I. I tell myself, okay, I'm going to direct my attention. It feels like my attention. I direct it to an object of focus. It could be the breath. We did different objects. It could be sensations. It could be in the body. It could be emotional states. But there's still an I directing an attention to the object. So the positions are, there's a subject, knowing an object. So there's another way to say that, there's the knower, there's the knowing, and there's the known. That's the starting place. But as the attention gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and especially as, even though it only happens sometimes just for moments, but when the mind stops doing language, telling yourself about the experience, for a while there's just the knowing. And you've all had this experience. You may not have had it long enough to recognize it as a particular form of experience, but when you're just knowing, it's cold. So you can start. The mind might be saying, I'm cold, but if you can direct the attention just to the sensation, you can sort of know it's unpleasant without having to have a word for that. And then there's just the knowing of the unpleasant sensation of coldness. And as the concentration strengthens, the person knowing the coldness disappears, and so does the object being known. And there's just knowing happening. There's just a flow of knowing happening. And the subject and the object do disappear, even in that practice. And all we did more explicitly this afternoon was try to say, look, it's just the mind knows thing. Knowing is possible. Rest in the knowing mind. Now, in that knowing place, you can notice a sound arises and a sound passes. And then we just extended it from there. And hopefully you had a taste of the experience of just resting in this knowing mind where everything, body, thoughts, things, just came and went and came and went. And if you, it's possible to sort of identify with the knowing. From that perspective, that it's a taste of the unconditioned. I think Joanna talked about that today in the answer to that question about God. There's just knowing. The knowing is not conditioned. There's some question about it, whether it arises and passes or not. Stephen actually made an interesting comment the other night that even consciousness, which is he was using as that which knows what's arising, he was saying some people teach that it doesn't exist separate from the object. And other people, I think differently, that it's actually a taste of the unconditioned. And then it manifests here in the body by knowing objects. And some people make a distinction between consciousness and awareness, for those two ideas. So I like having this approach from Buber, because it allows for the relational model. So I think in an absolute sense, in that four worlds model, in Atzilut, it is a non-dualistic reality. That is a reality of the divine. But what I like about bringing in this Jewish mystical overlay to mindfulness is that it sort of says, yes, you want to do that practice, but not the only practice, because in that practice of just being the knowing, it's really good for cultivating equanimity. It is a truth of the nature of the divine nature of the universe, but it's not the whole truth. And so this approach gives a lot of credence to the physical world, and then in particular for this talk, this idea of connecting allows both for a sense of separateness, because we have a sense of an I, because we have bodies, and from that place we need, because we're separate, we need to say, you know, please help me, I need you, I need help, it's not enough in here, I need help. And it allows for credence, for that's also an expression of the divine, is connecting, and because it's relational, there's still a subject and there's still an object, but they're not completely separate. And in their linkage, when the I and when the and is manifesting between us, I think there's still it's a relational model. I still sort of have a sense of an I when I'm in an I and thou moment, and there's still a sense of an object. But they're not separate anymore. And in that sense, the separate self disappears. There's still a sense of a self, and there's still a sense of another, but it's not a separate self. It's the, and you can notice it because the whole internal dialogue shifts too. When you're in that place, the way the mind is conceiving reality shifts. When you're in I-it, you know, I want, I need, it's self-centered, it's selfish, it's self-aggrandizing. And those are the thoughts that go, I need to have this. The mind shuts down, makes it harder to connect. But when you're in an I and thou moment, the thoughts in the mind are caring thoughts, loving thoughts, what does the other person need thoughts. Those manifest. You can see the difference in the even in the languaging in the mind. Different language arises. Different. I think you could talk about that as more sacred. I think I like to talk about the level of ruach and connection as the level that we call holiness. Because I think my understanding of holiness is the interconnected nature of reality. I think that's what's holy. When we're separate, we're in mundane reality, and it can become profane. But when we are feeling connected, I think that connection is an experience of love, an experience of holiness. Holiness is the feeling of connection. And that's why I think sometimes that world is called, that's why we have the term Ruach HaKodesh, that we actually apply that term Kodesh to Ruach, to this level of connecting, not being separate anymore. But it's a world where it's a reality and a way of practicing that really cares about what's happening in the world. There is a place where, from the place of equanimity, which is also true, there's a place from there that certainly can be experienced. Sometimes I've had the experience in that place that's a little bit cool. There's all these things arising, and sort of not quite so what, but you know, I'm not. If you identify just with the knowing, it's like, oh, that arose and that arose and that arose and that arose and that arose. And if what's arising is the noticing of suffering, I want to have more of a relationship to it. I want to be in this relational model. So I really like that this is a relational model. And so I have to do this in my when I say the prayers, if I'm going to then say Baruch Atah, I have to have this whole. I'm not always there experientially, but that's what I mean. I can't say you. I can't say Baruch Atah authentically unless I'm in this experience of feeling connected to whatever it is I'm saying the you to. I'm feeling connected to the prayer, feeling connected to the person. The word you can come out of your mouth. It's just a word of speech, but it's not what's being experienced internally, even though you might be saying you. But from this perspective, if I'm saying you in the prayers, it's because I'm saying the way I can say you to God is to recognize that God is not separate from me. It's not the God that's separate from me. So really saying you is, to really say you means you have to be in relationship, and the connection has to be manifesting, and that's a prerequisite to love. The connection has to be there. I think love is relational. I think love needs an object, and needs for connection to be manifesting. Now, I want to bring it back into our own practice here, which is this idea of being in a relational mode applies to our own experience too. Not only to each other. We want to be an I and you experience with each other, but I think we can also move into I and thou experience with our own with our practice, even as we as a way of relating moment by moment to what's arising, to start seeing it I think that's what we're doing in mindfulness. We're trying to be connected to whatever's arising. We're bringing awareness. Awareness, because of the power of awareness, and because of the power of and the possibility of connecting, we make a connection between asiya, between what's happening in this body, and what's happening on the awareness level. This is all the divine manifesting through us. The awareness aspect of the divine, because of the ruach aspect of the divine, can connect to the asiya aspect of the divine that's manifesting right here. And It's that connecting. It's the that then allows wisdom to arise, which is the neshama level. Because once the connection is there, we're loving, but there's also then the chance to see what's happening, and we can get wiser and wiser about what's happening in our own experience and in this very body. But we can also, the experience itself of bringing kind attention to our sensory experience moment by moment is a tremendously loving experience. If we give that to ourselves, as we learn to be more and more to be able to do that, I think we experience the love that we're all yearning for, and it becomes less and less mandatory that it come from outside. It's great when it comes from outside too. It doesn't, and in fact, the more we get in touch with loving ourselves, which then includes allowing ourselves to know ourselves better, we actually are more able, because we understand how the whole process works internally, we also understand that everybody else is having the same process going on, and so it does actually help us to love others. But I think so many of us are struggling with loneliness, sadness, and there is really the possibility of falling in love with yourself, of bringing such a level of clear. This is just the description of mindfulness that we started with the opening night. Just by bringing clear, non-judgmental awareness to the truth of each moment of experience, ruach manifests. That is the connection is happening. It feels loving. It's much more loving to feel your own sorrow than to try to push it away. We do try to push it away because we have limbic brains. So we have a part of our brain says unpleasant, bad, get rid of it. Pleasant, good. But that's just the reptilian brain. And it's fine. It's not a problem. You have to listen to that. It's a part of reality. But we can fall in love with ourselves through this practice. And so this is the last piece then to add into how this all works. So the process of saying you to the divine, saying you to the universe, saying you to yourself, that saying depends on listening. So that was the point I started to make at the beginning, that really the way to say you to God is to listen. Just by listening, the mind changes, and and it's in the act of listening. You don't have to say out loud, "I love you," to have the experience of "I love you," and for that experience to manifest. And it comes through listening. And I certainly, to a big extent, have my partner Joanna to thank for this teaching, both initially and in reminding me. So when Joanna tells me things that are going on for her that may be difficult, the part of my mind, that's an unpleasant object, and that's an unpleasant object. I want to solve that. I want to get rid of that unpleasant object. I want to get rid of that unpleasant object, whether for her or for me. And she's been good enough to point out to me that, when I say these things to you, I just want you to listen. I don't want you to have to fix up. You don't have to fix me. You don't have to fix anything. Just all I want you to do is listen. Because that's where the connection happens, just to listen. Now, Buber used to say that I and thou moments, in this book, Buber used to say that this is the manifesting of the and, is sort of a moment of grace, that you can't make it happen. But I think, there is an ultimate truth to that. At some point, there is some grace involved somehow. But I do think this practice we're doing of listening and paying attention and paying attention and paying attention makes it much more likely that the grace will unfold. So there does seem to be some sort of a moment where it just happens. But and you can't quite try to control that, because that's the I-it, it's the I-it sense of wanting it to be a certain way that then gets in the way of it happening. So at some point, you can't try to make it happen exactly, but you can bring all of your attention, and then it's much more likely that it does happen. And because the real saying of you happens in the silence, I just want to finish that beginning phrase from the psalm. So, Lecha Dumiyat Tehillah. All it takes is to really be there in silence, and then the silence is experienced as praise. I've noticed, and a lot of people will report this on meditation retreats. When you cultivate this ability to listen, and then you go out into nature, many, many people have experiences with other beings, especially with the animal beings, that they never have except when they're doing this practice. When they've cultivated this careful listening, and this careful listening, it's understood. It's happens on a non. There's a non-verbal thing that happens. So people, all of a sudden, they walk right up to deer and they don't run away. And as many, many people report that there is something that's happening on a non-verbal level. So it doesn't need to be to use silence as praise. Just getting there, the praise, the connection. It's directly knowable, directly experienced. Ribbono shel olam, Ribbono shel olam, Ribbono shel olam, Ribbono shel olam, Ribbono shel olam. Ich will dir a dudele singen, du, 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 du. So I offer those thoughts. This is a line I learned from one of my teachers now. I used to say, thank you for your kind attention, which, by the way, thank you for your kind attention. I really do feel that. And the other thing he says, which I think is really good, is... I offer this for your reflection. This is for you to see what's true. It's just for you to reflect with in your own experience. Let's just sit for a minute.